start, and we're going to discuss business combinations under common control. I give the floor to Julia.
Carla will introduce our
Carla. Okay.
Thank you, Julia. And good afternoon, board members. At last month's meeting, we discussed the information needs of different types of primary users.
You sound a bit overpowering.
So we discussed the information needs of different types of primary users, of the receiving entity's financial statements, and how those information needs are considered in developing measurement approaches for transactions within the scope of the project. The board also discussed whether a predecessor approach could be applied for transactions between wholly owned entities, in particular those that affect lenders and other creditors in the receiving entity and prospective equity investors in an IPO. The session was educational and no decisions were made. At this meeting, we would like to ask you if you agree with the staff's approach to developing measurement alternatives for transactions within the scope of the project, and whether you agree with our conclusion for transactions that affect lenders and other creditors in the receiving entity. With that, let us move on to Agenda Paper 23A. The paper provides an update of the staff's approach and summarizes the inputs received to date. In principle, assuming the same composition of primary users, we think that to the extent that BCUCC are similar to business combinations within the scope of IFRS 3, the same method should apply. And to the extent that they may be different, the acquisition method might need to be modified. This is our central conceptual consideration. However, if the composition of primary users is different, the conclusion about what approach should apply could be different as well. Because, as discussed in the conceptual framework, different primary users may have different or even conflicting information needs. For example, the board could decide that different approaches should apply for all or some transactions that affect NCI and for transactions between wholly owned entities. In addition, if the composition of primary users is different for business combination within the scope of IFRS 3 and BCUCC, the cost-benefit analysis could be different as well. Finally, in developing measurement alternatives for transactions within the scope of the project, we also seek to avoid unnecessary complexity and to minimize structuring opportunities. We have discussed the staff's approach at various meetings, most recently at the March 2019 CMAC and EEG meetings, and at the April 2019 ASAF meeting. Most members were supportive of the staff's approach. For example, CMAC members who commented on the staff's approach supported the use of a current value for transactions that affect NCI in the receiving entity. They agreed that a form of predecessor approach would provide useful information to prospective equity investors in an IPO. They also agreed that the result of credit analysis would be largely unaffected by whether a current value approach or a predecessor approach is used for transactions that affect lenders and other creditors. No CMAC members disagreed with the staff's conclusions. Similarly, ASAF members who commented on the topic generally agreed with the use of a form of predecessor approach for transactions between wholly owned entities, including transactions that affect lenders and other creditors in the receiving entity, and transactions undertaken in preparation of an IPO. Most ASAP members also agreed that the board could pursue different approaches for transactions that affect NCI and those that affect lenders and other creditors. Two ASAP members disagreed with considering composition of and information needs of primary users in developing developing approaches for transactions within the scope of the project. Instead, they suggested focusing on common information needs of all primary users. One member suggested focusing on the substance of BCUCC. That member argued that the substance of BCUCC is different from business combinations within the scope of IFRS 3. Because the parent controls all combining entities before and after the transaction. And that all BCUCC should therefore be accounted applying a form of predecessor approach. As discussed in paragraphs 19 and 20 of Agenda Paper 23A, we have considered the substance of BCUCC. And we think that BCUCC have commercial substance for the receiving entity and for the primary users of its financial statements. Before the transaction, the receiving entity did not control the acquired business. After the transaction, it does. Therefore, we think that a test based on the presence or absence of commercial substance will not provide a useful basis for distinguishing different types of business combinations under common control. Our question to the board is set out in paragraph 23. We ask the board whether the board agree with the staff's approach to developing measurement alternatives for transactions within the scope of the project by considering the following. whether and how transactions within the scope of the project can be different from business combinations that are not under common control. What information would be useful to various primary users of the receiving entity's financial statements? Whether the benefits of providing particular information would justify the cost of providing that information, and complexity and structuring opportunities that could arise under various approaches. And if not, what other approach would you like us to explore?
Mary?
Carlo, I have three comments on the conclusions, recommendations in this paper. The first one goes to what you said in paragraph 21A, whether and how the transactions are different from business combinations under common control, and the point that you make in paragraph 6B1, that one of the different characteristics, and I'm going to put some words in your mouth, so apologies for that, is that in a combination of entities under common control, we don't have the presumption of equal fair value because it's not an arm's length transaction. So that's one of the differences in characteristics. And you note the consequence of that in paragraph 6B1 when you say, you know, we've got to think about the accounting for any contribution or distribution. And I think that is important. And I just, you know, I guess it's captured by the generic statement in paragraph 21A, but I just wanted to encourage you to bring that out more so it doesn't get lost in the shuffle, because I think that is one of the things we have to keep in mind. And second is an observation that I think the feedback that you had about the information needs of prospective investors and of lenders and other creditors and their ability to work with either set of information is very helpful in terms of saying, let's focus on defining the population that needs one specific type of information. And so that lets us focus on whose needs we have to consider, and then given the greater cost of that acquisition base, think how far that should extend. Now, in that regard, I wanted, and apologies, I didn't get a chance to chat with you about this before the meeting. The phrase we've been using for a while now is whether or not the transactions affect NCI in the receiving entity. Now, strictly speaking, an NCI in the receiving entity would relate to other shareholders in subsidiaries of the receiving entity. And I think what we actually want to capture is not only those external shareholders and subsidiaries of the receiving entity, but also if there are shareholders who are not part of the controlling party. So I don't think we can just call it NCI in the receiving entity, but it's external shareholders in the receiving entity, i.e. non-common control. So it's a phrasing thing. But I think from all the discussions, it's been clear what you were talking about, because let's say the receiving entity is 85% of the ownership is with the controlling entity, but 15% is with outside stakeholders. I think if that's the only interest that's not owned by the controlling party, we were thinking of that as that 15% held by outside parties may be affected by the transaction. And so, but that, strictly speaking, is not NCI at the receiving entity level.
Thank you. So as I mentioned last month, I really like the work that staff have done on the needs of lenders and other creditors. And I guess, as I mentioned then, I'm still interested in understanding the needs of equity investors. I found, even where there was an NCI present, that there was more indifference from members. Perhaps it was a different take on the meeting. And one of the things which I think we have an issue with CMAC members, they're not familiar largely with these transactions. I mean, it's an alien world, bar one or two exceptions in that group. And whether we have to do more work speaking to investors who are more used to these transactions, I think that might be helpful. Having said that, and thinking about the distinguishing feature of these transactions of business combination under common control transactions, it is that they're not done at arm's length. And I guess that got me to think about what is the best, for me as a provider of capital, what would be the best mechanism to protect me in those circumstances to give me the information? And I appreciate we'll be discussing it tomorrow, but actually my take is it's the disclosures that we're going to discuss in paper 18B around the terms of the transaction and the subsequent performance of those acquisitions. And I just wonder whether that's an avenue that we should explore at least. And I'd want that information, whether we went down a predecessor route for some transactions or a current value, irrespective, that would be the information as a user that I would be looking for. And obviously, above and beyond that, we have these cost considerations. And I wonder whether just putting that into the equation, I just want to sow the seed, really, to think whether that's a variable that we could think about and may give us some more flexibility in terms of how we take this forward. That's all I'm saying.
Jen Chow.
Thank you, Hans. As Nick said, I appreciate the staff's staff did a lot of research and engaged the stakeholders. The paper is good. And with regard to paragraph 21 and 22, verse 21, I generally agree. I think we should explore those questions first, then decide which direction we should have. With regard to those questions, I think first paragraph 21A, actually it's relevant to the nature of the BCUCC. Or the economic substance of the BCUCC. And I think currently we always look from the receiving entity perspective. It's okay, no problem. But we should not ignore that actually those BCUCC normally dominated by the controlling party. So we should not ignore that the parents always there. And the controlling party director, those subsidiaries or those businesses to merge it together. And this is make difference between BCUCC and business combination, not under common control. So this kind of impact influence should not be ignored when we look at the nature of economic substance. Secondly, I think during the CMAC meeting, especially during the ASAP meeting, I think many members mentioned what's the purpose of the financial statement. I think our financial statement is a general purpose financial statement. Try to meet the common information needs of the users, not differentiate different information needs of different users. So I think this is the starting point we should look at. Currently we focus on NCI, creditors, Nick said that maybe we need to look at the equity investors, but I think we should try to bring together what's the common information needs of those users as the starting point, as again. Thirdly, with the item of paragraph 22, because you ask that the board whether agree to there is no need to persuade a single approach that would apply both to different cases. I think for me, it's a still a lot at an earlier stage, because without those research or the question answered based on paragraph 21, it's very difficult to answer or convince me whether single approach or not single approach we should adopt. So with regard to the Nick said that maybe another alternative, if we could bear in mind, such as precessor method plus fair value disclosure, can meet both, you know, those stakeholders, those users. Somebody would like the fair value information with regard to transaction itself, but maybe they not favor the subsequent, you know, measurement. I think can consider both in common information needs from different users. So I hesitated to agree with on paragraph 22, but 21 really, I think, worthwhile to explore those questions first.
I just wanted to say that it would be really helpful for us if we have the discussion about the overall approach and then the discussion about what we do lenders and credit. So basically, if we vote separately on agenda paper 23A and 23B, so the first question is about, do you agree with how we sort of approach the analysis? And then the question about what we do with lenders and creditors is a separate question. So if we can keep it separately, it would really be helpful for us.
Amaru.
Thanks, Sus. Overall, I do agree with staff. Suggestion to continue develop measurement approach in this way. I think Mary made a very interesting comment on the NCI, so language is very important. And particularly, I would like to stress the point of distinct approach. I've been hearing recently during the EEG meeting the feedback from various countries, and it's clearly that there is no preference for one approach or the other. However, the predecessor approach seems to appear very frequently as one approach that could be used in certain circumstances. So I do believe at this stage that the potential outcome, the best potential outcome for this project would be distinct approach if we are able to really establish clearly in which situations they would provide the best information for users in general. And of course, as Nick stressed, we are going to seek more feedback from users and not only limited to CMAQ. This would be very important. But I think the direction of the staff at this moment is correct. I tend to agree with paragraph 22 as well, because if we do not provide you a clear route to continue exploring the potential, we will keep going in two different directions. And that's only one comment on Jinqiao's suggestion, maybe to explore disclosure using predecessor for recognition and fair value for disclosure. I think it's very expensive. We are either comfortable with one approach if it fulfills the expectation of users, but I think would be potentially very costly if we do require fair value as well to be disclosed.
Chamu.
Thank you. I generally agree with your direction, but I have two comments. One is 21, paragraph 21D. You are going to investigate some kind of complexity and structuring opportunities that could arise. That's a good idea, but as Mr. Amaro said, there are already some kind of events and some kind of misuse exist in the market, because there are already there are many companies who are using the current value approach or book value approach, present test approach. So in future, we are going to develop kind of a form of these basically two approaches. What I'm saying is we might ask our national standard setters, our friends, to give us some kind of a real events, happenings in markets, when they use their kind of a current value approach, there is something, some kind of misuse. Or if there is some kind of a misuse from the predecessor method. So they can give us all kind of cases. Then that will help us to when we develop this kind of old directions. You don't have to wait until the maybe some years, some period later, if we can collect that kind of information. So that's one suggestion. Another thing is, this is related to paragraph 18C. It's you gave us a very interesting result. In the case of prospective equity investors, they just don't want a kind of predecessor method. That's a kind of against my original expectation. Maybe these prospective equity investors might have kind of a good interest in current value approach rather than predecessor method. But this is a very interesting result. Do you know why these are prospective equity investors would like to have some kind of value based on the predecessor method?
So what we discussed with those stakeholders is similar to the discussion we had with the board last month. So I suppose the gist of the argument is that because it's under common control, the parent could decide essentially how to structure the transaction, and the parent could thus decide which entity is the acquirer and which entities are acquirees. And by doing that, the parent could decide if the acquisition method were to be applied, which assets would be at fair value and which assets would be at historical amounts. And what we heard pretty consistently is that in an IPO scenario, having a mixed and match of measurement basis is not helpful. So either all assets and liabilities going for an IPO should be at historical cost, or all assets and liabilities going for an IPO should be at fair value. But having some of them at fair value and having others at historical cost is not helpful. We need to do more analysis on the IPO scenario, which is why we haven't brought it today, but this is sort of the gist of the argument.
Doug.
Thank you. I was going to ask exactly that same point. Are we going to discuss the from the viewpoint of prospective equity investors analysis?
Yes.
We are going to do that. Right. And actually, the Yuria's explanation was really interesting. For those who are going to make a new investment to the receiving entity, maybe having a single measurement basis is much better than the mixture, or the different measurement basis depends on the receiving entity or cases. So then the question is, would it apply to other primary users as well or not? That is really the question. And then what we are going to focus is NCI, shareholders of NCI. And the shareholders of NCI would be the existing shareholders of the NCI. The existing shareholders of NCI before IPO is maybe the unlisted entities NCI. Then the NCI after the IPO, then it's a NCI of listed NCI. So there might be the differences. And maybe that is the area we need to consider and scrutinize well, what is the information needs and what will happen. And the one thing we could say is at least we should protect very innocent NCI holder to the listed entity. That is no matter what way, either recognition way or disclosure way, we need to protect them. That is what we can say throughout this project. Thank you.
Daryl. So I was originally going to respond directly to some of the things that Nick raised, which I thought were really important, but I think some of them stray between paper 21A and 21B. So I'll stick with 21, paragraph 21 at the moment, which I think is the critical one for the purposes of this discussion. So firstly, I agree with all four proposals that you've got in there. And I think it's important that I think these are the issues that we need to be picking up as part of this project. And I'm comfortable with the direction you're taking. A little bit in response to what Nick was saying, on B, what information is available to the various primary users. I think what jumped out from Nick's comment on the CMAQ feedback is perhaps just the thought that some of the international stock exchanges are structured in different ways. So certainly I know in South Africa, and I think in a number of other countries, there is a lot more listed minorities. And I think that may be relevant because it sounded like that's an unusual thing, I think, in the CMAQ experience. But I think from a South African perspective, an investor in a listed minority doesn't really think differently to an investor in a non-listed minority. They think about themselves, not about who the other shareholders might be. And I suspect it just suggests that as we do that, or as we think about primary users, we might need to look beyond perhaps the developed economies to the developing economies where these types of structures are more apparent.
Councilor Eisen.
I would like to express support for the approach that the staff is proposing in that paper. I very much support the focus on users' needs in the way it is proposed and already partly carried out. So,
okay, Gary.
And, first of all, to the team, I thought all the papers were very good. And in general, better than generally agree with the conclusions in paragraph 22. And just a couple of comments, some build generally on stuff people said earlier. Off paragraph 21, as I do think those are the questions that need pursuit. On 21D about structuring opportunities, and I just think we need to be clear, especially since this will get translated to many languages. We're talking about accounting arbitrage and accounting opportunities. All these transactions are a structuring opportunity. Companies just don't move things around because they have nothing else to do. They're structuring the corporate structure for a purpose, you know, and it's to achieve some business thing, but it's all done by structuring, you know, who owns what of whom. So just need to be clear, we're always talking accounting arbitrage type opportunities and not business opportunities. I think a couple of comments, and talk raised them. I'd just like to build on them, and maybe some other people did too. I mean, there's different groups of NCI holders, and talk raised what I'll call it the innocent NCI, the people that already have the NCI positions. I think they're a different primary user group than I think an IPO group is. In fact, I don't think we should even think about IPOs. Certain prospective shareholders in here, and the reason why IPOs are subject to extensive underwriting due diligence and M&A type work and fairness opinions, they're not relying in general, I don't think, on the financial statements in there. You're looking about, this is underwriting. They got deep dive exams into the accounts, so in that sense, those are not general purpose financial statement analysis. So that's I think IPOs, plus I think one of the staff papers probably a year or two ago on the said, you know, there might be 200 IPOs a year in here, and there's, you know, I think we had one search, we had at least 8,000 instances of NCI transactions and IFRS reporting. So it's a fairly small subset, but again, I think it's a unique transaction with a lot of experts helping you know, the due diligence, the syndicate being put together to buy these things. And then I do think there might be another class of primary users, which would be if the subsidiary has, you have NCI, but you have authorizations just to routinely issue other shares that are registered, and they're not getting it through an IPO, just I'm allowed to sell some more shares. I think they should be thought of as the prospective shareholders, as opposed to an M&A type transaction. Thank you.
Jim Chow.
Thank you. So just to clarify one thing, as Amaro mentioned, my proposal said precession method plus fair value disclosure. What I mean fair value disclosure, that it's only required at the acquisition date or the first annual report date, not subsequently. Every year you should do an exercise and disclose based on a fair value approach. This is why I say, because if you go to the fair value or current value approach, the cost is really high. I agree with your point. So this is why I say, because the first year, when the receiving entity acquire that business, they will value the assets and liability they acquired. So this kind of information already available. So it's really easy for them to disclose and to let the NCI or shareholders, users know that. It's very easy. And another thing, listening to the views of NCI, I'm thinking about that. I think we should be very careful that whatever current value or precession value we're using, the objective try to reflect the transactions, face value represent the transactions, not to protect the NCI. Every country have legal protection mechanism there, governance requirements there, disclosure. I mean, this is not our responsibility. Our responsibility try to faithfully represent the economic consequences, economic substance of the transactions. This is our objective. Just to clarify. Yeah.
Thank you. Tom.
Just a couple of small comments. Just a bit sympathetic to what Jin Chao said and what Amaro said. I think Amaro, you talked about if it can be sufficiently distinct. So I would agree just with 22. In 22, I would agree there's no need to pursue, but I would not interpret that as I would rule out having one. So I think that's really important when you go back. I think that's sympathetic to what Jin Chao said, that if it makes a lot of sense to have one approach that seems to be best for all the common, then we should consider it. So we're not ruling out at this time. But I am sympathetic to following the path that the staff indicated. On just another small point on 21D, and this I'm actually going to go back to 13B. I don't really agree with the statement in 13B. It said structuring opportunities, a little bit to kind of consistent with what Gary said, but structuring opportunities unavoidable unless you decide to do the acquisition method. Again, in the U.S., they specifically didn't do the acquisition method to avoid structuring. So there are different views on this. And I think that's just a bit too strong. I know kind of where you're coming from, but structuring can happen a number of ways. You can choose who acquires whom, like you said. You can choose the method. You know, there's a number of things you can do. So I don't think we should be so strong as in 13B.
So maybe just to clarify what we mean in 13B, what we're saying here is essentially that as long as the board draws some kind of line somewhere between some types of business combinations, there will be an opportunity for accounting arbitrage. I take Gary's point completely, you know, whether you fall one side of the line or another. So at the moment, we have requirements for business combinations. It's the acquisition method. And there are no requirements for business combinations under common control, so you have flexibility what to do. And so today, you know, people are trying to sort of either get in the scope of IFRS 3 or out of the scope of IFRS 3 to achieve a particular accounting outcome. And so the whole point here is that as long as there is a line, there will always be potentially a possibility to try and fall one side of the line or another. That's all we're saying.
So it was between things in the scope of IFRS 3 and not, as opposed to different categories within BCEC.
Yeah, exactly.
Can I just clarify where we are in the papers?
Yeah.
So paragraph 22 in paragraph A is actually referring to paper B.
I think that's what's creating.
And I think we've got ourselves a little bit confused. So we're sticking at the moment to paragraph 20 to paper 23A.
Yes.
Which means only paragraph 21, yes. Not paragraph 22.
Yes. Even though the question in paper 23A refers to both paragraphs, I think really what you want us to, this board to focus on is paragraph 21 mainly at the moment.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, sir. And actually, in the question to the board, the question specifically does refer to paragraph 21.
And 22 is
my version. Okay.
No, I'm going to go 21.
Okay. Anne?
Like others, I agree with the approach proposed in paragraph 21. I didn't have anything to add to that. Chung Wu said to go to national standard setters and get more research, and certainly there's research out there. One of the things that I've been reading that I found very interesting was that there's a group of people who are doing BCUCC, these are IFRS adopters, and they're in Europe. And this study looked at them over a number of years, and it didn't matter which one they chose. Did they choose fair value under, they are BCUCC. Did they choose fair value, or did they choose some version of predecessor? And what the study showed was that there was no difference in the next outcomes. So in the returns that these companies were getting in the share market in the future, there was no significant difference. And I just wonder if that's relevant to this idea that we're hearing that some people are neutral as to which method. They don't have a strong preference on the method. So that was one thing that I wanted to share. The other thing touches on the point that's come up now about structuring, and Yulia has clarified what that particular paragraph means on structuring, because we know that within any accounting methods, people find ways to get to certain outcomes if they're that way inclined. And this same research paper shows that within that choice, the group that chose to do IFRS 3, the acquisition method, were a group that managed to get their leverage down. They were also more likely to get public debt in the next period. So this is within IFRS 3. They're choosing certain ways of applying. They're choosing IFRS 3 rather than a predecessor method because they can get a particular outcome that they want. So I think that that's just relevant to that point that where Yulia has clarified what we meant by no a less structuring opportunity under IFRS 3.
Mary?
I just wanted to go back to Jean Zhao's last comment about the purpose of financial statements, because I think he took issue rightly with the statement that we should be trying to protect the NCI. I don't think the staff intended that that was a corporate governance type protection, but rather that the NCI might have different information needs because as, and I'm using the NCI term loosely, because they may be concerned about a transaction that was driven by the common controller of the two entities that might have impacted the economics of their interest, and that might make the fair value information that IFRS 3 delivers more relevant to them if it helps highlight a contribution or a distribution when that issue may not exist. So I agree that we shouldn't be trying to build accounting incentives or disincentives for the transactions, but I think it may be useful to spell out a bit more, how we connect the dots between the information needs and what their information needs, why they may be different, and what kind of considerations they have, and that goes back to that paragraph 6B, 1 or 2 point.
Who?
I agree with the general approach that you've set out in paragraph 21. I just wanted to comment, though, on the last point on 21D. I agree we should be sort of conscious of any structural opportunities that we might be creating, particularly when we talk about drawing lines in particular places, as we have in some of the things we've been thinking about. But I think we should not let that dominate us, because I don't think we're well served when people think we're doing things for anti-avoidance reasons. And also, I think what we mean here by structuring is falling on one side of the line and whether there's incentives to want to be on one side of the line or the other. And I'm keen to keep away from this whole sort of moral aspect of things, that we're sort of setting ourselves up as the international accounting police to stop
bad transactions happening, not least because I think sometimes people talk about the fact that business combinations under common control that might achieve particular tax outcomes are sometimes perceived as being sort of bad. But on one sense, if they have real cash flow outcomes, they are, that they've got economic consequences. And so I think we, the more we can stay away from those sort of moral things, the better, and focus on, doesn't mean I don't, I absolutely agree with what Mary said, it's thinking about what information do these people need to be making informed decisions, which is a more sort of neutral objective.
Okay, can I see whether we support this class?
Just paragraph 21.
Good afternoon, board members. Agenda paper 23B provides an update on the information needs of existing and potential lenders and other creditors in BUCCC that the board discussed last month. In particular, it discusses input received at the March 2019 CMAC and EENG meetings. As you may recall, the staff identified three characteristics in which claims held by debt investors are typically different from equity claims. These are covered in paragraph 10. These characteristics influence both the information required for credit analysis and the way the information is used. The staff noted that lenders and creditors focus in their analysis on assessing entities' ability to service the existing debt and to raise new debt. Our research and outreach showed that core prediction models used for credit analysis tend to display a predominance of cash flow analysis and a focus on the total gross debt, including a recognized commitments and contingent liabilities. As explained in paragraphs 18 to 28 of Agenda Paper 23C, these forms of analysis would be largely affected by whether a current value approach or a form of predecessor approach is used to account for a BUCCC. Accordingly, the staff think that the board did not pursue a single approach for BUCCC that affect NCI in the receiving entity and those that affect lenders and other creditors in the receiving entity but do not affect NCI. Specifically, the board could pursue a current value approach for all or some transactions that affect NCI in the receiving entity, and a different approach, such as a form of predecessor approach for transactions that affect lenders and other creditors in the receiving entity but do not affect NCI. The staff acknowledged that debt investors and credit analysts also consider valuation, profitability ratios, and ratios based on the statement of the financial position, in particular debt to equity ratios. However, those considerations are secondary to the focus on cash flows and total gross debt and tend to have a limited impact on the outcome of debt analysis. CMAC members, including members specializing in credit analysis, agreed with the staff's analysis and conclusions, in particular that the result of those, that the result of the credit analysis would be largely unaffected by whether a current value approach or a form of predecessor approach is used to account for a BUCCC. We have also discussed the staff's analysis and conclusions at the March 2019 ENG meeting and the April ASAF meeting. Most members agreed with the staff's analysis and supported using a form of a predecessor approach for transactions that affect lenders and other creditors of the receiving entity but do not affect NCI. The majority of the ASAF members also supported the staff's conclusion that the board could pursue different approaches for BUCCC that affect NCI in the receiving entity and those that affect lenders and other creditors in the receiving entity. Staff conclusions are summarized in paragraph 20 to 22, and question for the board is presented in paragraph 22. Does the board agree with the staff's conclusion in paragraph 22 that it need not pursue a single approach for BUCCC that affect NCI in the receiving entity and those that affect lenders and other creditors in the receiving entity, but do not affect NCI?
And maybe just to clarify our question to the points that Tom made earlier, we're not asking you at the moment which approach should apply to that affect lenders and creditors, and we also do not ask you to decide that the board must pursue two different approaches in those scenarios. The only question we asked at the moment is whether you agree that you do not need to pursue a single approach for those transactions.
Darrell?
So I think the evidence we have gathered so far in terms of the way people use information around, depending on what their objective is, equity or would suggest to me very strongly that we should be pursuing at least pursuing the two. Even if we down the line, to Tom's point, don't conclude on the two, I think that there's a lot of merit in considering that, given that the cost-benefit equation changes depending on how the information is being used. This was the other point that I wanted to respond to, Nick, on the point that you were making, because I think we've heard a bit in the last couple of months about the various merits of whether the predecessor method provides better information or the acquisition method provides better information. I think that's one way of thinking about the outcome of this process. But I think a different way of thinking about it is what information the investor needs when they approach a set of financial statements. And the example that I was thinking about specifically in the South African context is one of the really big listed companies is 53% owned by its holding company, 47% is owned by other shareholders. If I'm approaching that purely as a shareholder who's looking at a whole portfolio of listed entities, do I want to think that whether or not that is consolidated up or whether the holding company is determining a control relationship exists changes a fundamental element of the accounting? And I think the answer there is probably no. And it's easy when it's 53%, 47% because it's easy to conclude. But there are a couple of other borderline ones, certainly in South Africa and I imagine elsewhere in the world, where the ownership is held, the controlling entity only holds 45%, but determines that 45% is enough to give it control. And therefore, I think that would qualify as a business combination under common control. And you have a situation where you are part of the majority shareholders, but potentially you could see your share subject to a different accounting. Mm-hmm. So I think just in terms of thinking about the perspective, I think we're thinking about two things. The useful information one, which I think, as Nick said, is something that we need to consider. And then the second element, I think, is just what the normal assumption is of a shareholder approaching those shares, and do they expect different accounting for reasons that they might have to investigate, depending on who the other shareholder happens to be. And then, Nick, I just wanted to confirm on your point about 18B, which I think is absolutely valid. My view would be that if we were to follow the acquisition method, all the luggage goes with it, if that makes sense. So would 18B and any conclusions we make under that. But I wanted to take a step further and just think, if are you thinking that you would also expect that under the predecessor method?
I would.
And are you concluding that on the basis, because the predecessor method, so that those disclosures, I can see how they make sense, but would that disclosure be from the context of a creditor,
yep,
type of creditors and lenders? So you think it's useful from that perspective as well? Okay.
Yeah, certainly when we've talked in CMAC meetings where we do have representative credit investors, they have fully supported that type of disclosure around a normal business combination, and I think that would then help them.
I suppose the reason I'm sort of thinking about it is what happens is that 100% shareholding together with predecessor accounting lends itself to off-market purchase prices. And that makes that sort of thing a little bit more difficult, because sometimes it's harder to follow what's actually been happening on a relative value perspective. If I underpaid for the investment, for example, because I've simply paid cost for the investment. And I think predecessor accounting would mean I don't have to recognize goodwill, potentially I don't have to recognize fair value. This would suggest that perhaps I do have to recognize those things. And that's the only thing I'd sort of throw in.
I'm not sure, because it's really a question of determining the consideration, which would be independent of those factors, and then As 18B says, you know, the type of synergies that are expected, level of sales on a pro forma basis, perhaps we have to debate operating profit. I'm not sure the accounting necessarily.
I think it's something to think about.
Indeed.
The reason why I'd probably raise the question is I think it rebalances the cost benefit back to sort of adding a lot more cost into those. So at least I think that is something we would need to think about in the context of what it is that the creditors and lenders want or need.
Okay.
Mary?
In terms of this question, I think we have to think very carefully about how we communicate it, because I think the point really is a cost-benefit consideration in terms of the cost of applying the acquisition method of accounting. And the reason I say that is, I think in terms of the complexity of IFRS standards, drawing boundaries, et cetera, it would be simpler to say there's a single method and that's it. And what we have been doing is looking to see whether there are populations of users of financial statements who could use information that is significantly less costly, rather than they have different information needs that are, quote, better satisfied by a different method of accounting. And I put quotes around better satisfied because when we talk about the predecessor method, there is no single predecessor method. There's a quite substantial variety of practice that falls under the heading of predecessor method. And so we aren't talking about there being a single method that has been shown to be more useful. It's just that certain people have not raised concerns about certain groups of transactions that have applied some form of predecessor method because the information from a cost-benefit perspective seems to satisfy their needs. So when you ask, do I agree with the proposals to pursue two methods? I think what I agree with is seeing whether there's a population we can define that would be satisfied by a less costly method, rather than I think we should be developing a different method to satisfy a different set of information needs. I think we're looking for cost relief. It's a different way of, I think, expressing the same thing. But if we were talking about simplicity and what you've said about the information needs, especially of lenders and other creditors, is that they could be satisfied by either. So it's just a question of, if they're the only ones, could they be satisfied with less, because less would be less costly? So that I have nuance in its messaging, but I think it's important to me. And one reason that it's important to me is, I think sooner or later, to me, there's almost an elephant in the room, which is instinctively the transactions for which, whether it's the paper 18B disclosures about post combination performance or whether it's full acquisition accounting, don't make as much sense as a truly administrative internal reorganization of wholly owned entities. And that doesn't feel like there's a purpose of a business combination is to get sales or rationalize. It might be solely administrative purposes. And those are the ones for which I think everybody would have cost concerns about applying IFRS 3 in full acquisition accounting, but we don't have a definition, you know, for a pure group restructuring and administrative reorganizing, and we aren't going at it that way. But at the end of the day, that's, I think, the population that says there's at least some group for which we feel all of the bells and whistles of acquisition accounting, including for me at least, the post-acquisition reporting on performance of how it went, you know, was the objective of the BizCom realized, don't seem necessary. And that, I think, isn't got at by this, you know, who, at least not obviously to me, by the who are the users of these financial statements. So I kind of make that as an observation, but my basic response to your question in paragraph 23A is I'm not positively for developing another approach or specifying another approach, but I think we're doing the right thing in terms of looking at whether we can have cost savings by defining a population for which the costlier exercise of acquisition accounting is not necessary.
Can I just maybe quickly clarify again how we're thinking about it? And I think we're thinking about it a little bit broader than just cost-benefit considerations. But let me start, first of all, by agreeing that we do agree that there is no sort of a single defined thing such as a predecessor method. And we were very careful in the set of paper to go from a predecessor method to go to a form of a predecessor method, just to make this point more prominent. Coming to the cost consideration, and we agree that cost-benefit analysis is very significant for business combinations under common control, but there is another layer we think before you even go to the cost analysis, which we're trying to highlight in Agenda Paper 23A. So the first layer that we look at is, are transactions the same, are they different, how can they be different? But then the second layer we look at is, what is the composition of primary users, and what are their information needs? So we are looking at this even before we consider cost-benefit. And I think the key consideration here is that if you have a business combination within the scope of IFRS 3, you will have
shareholders and you will have lenders and creditors, but you will not have a distinction between non-controlling shareholders and controlling party who already has all the information they need. So I think here we are looking at, I suppose, two big populations to begin with. We're looking at transactions between wholly owned entities as opposed to transactions which involve NCI. And then for the population where we have wholly owned entities, so then we think, okay, what about information needs of lenders and other creditors? And we conclude that they can work with either set of information. What are the information needs of prospective equity investors? And, you know, which prospective equity investors we focus on and how we consider those. But I think the focus here is what is useful information for transactions between wholly owned entities before you even get to the cost consideration. So just another layer in the analysis. Maybe we haven't made it very clear, and maybe we can...
So you're saying that they could cope with either current value or predecessor. So I'm looking at your first sentence in paragraph 13.
Yes.
They could cope with either.
Yeah.
Martin?
Yeah, I agree with the staff recommendation, but I have to say I have more and more difficulties to makes this kind of decision without really knowing that we have a proper acquisition method which we can use for a business combination under common control. Because when we started with this kind of situations where we think, okay, it is an overpayment or underpayment, so the transaction price is really not the fair value of the entity which is bought. And based on my understanding, we have not finalized the discussion and have not found the proper solution for that. And then on the other hand side, we're discussing, okay, predecessor method. I don't know what that is, because man, we always say people saying, okay, it is a kind of not common practice, different kind of things. I don't know what happens with kind of goodwill. So for me, it's more difficult. Before we have discussed, okay, what is really the method, what are the information needs, and are these information needs then fulfilled by this different method without really knowing what exactly that method is. And therefore, as I said, I agree with that. Could maybe have two different, but it's more and more difficult for me to follow the discussion than what is then the information needs of a lender without not knowing what predecessor method provides kind of information, what are the disclosure requirements. And so that is, I think we, at that point in time in the near future, we have to discuss more which kind of methods which we are discussing. Otherwise, it is difficult for me to say, okay, what I would prefer in different situations.
And that's a very fair point, Martin. And we definitely are planning to bring to the board papers on, you know, whether and how the acquisition method should be modified and also how the predecessor method should be applied. And we were particularly very careful with how we phrase this question. But, of course, we need to sequence the questions for the board in a particular order, as opposed to bring one package with all the questions in one meeting, and then if you disagree with something, going away and like redoing the whole thing. So we need some sort of sequence to follow.
My point was no, I think it's now time maybe to discuss.
Françoise.
Well, in fact, I would like to support the comments that Mary and Martin have made. I think, I mean, I've not moved from the decision we made originally, which was that all things being equal, the starting point should be the acquisition method. And I would warn us against not making decisions for the good arguments. In other words, I mean, we're dealing with this issue not in a vacuum, but I mean, in consistency with what we have in IFRS is. So there may be arguments against the validity of the acquisition method. I would not want this type of argument to pollute, I would call that pollution, sorry, the way we develop this model. I think if we depart from the acquisition method, it should be for reasoned arguments which are specific to the business combination and common control and not other possible variations on the theme of how to best reflect a business combination. So to me, that's an important point. And in that sense, that's how I support Mary's point, because, I mean, the way I support your approach, and I supported the analysis of lenders and creditors, but really in the sense of eventually the cost, the full cost of the acquisition method is not necessary for this restricted group of users to be satisfied in what they need. But it is, from my perspective, it remains a cost-benefit approach to the issue. It's not that I start, dividing or in any other way. So I support what Mary has said, and that does not contradict the conclusion that can be reached. And I also support the comments that Martin has made, because my support to this approach is in the context of what we have so far analyzed. And so I'm not promising that I would not change my view when we continue developing.
And Chao.
Thank you. My point is, I think the first priority, we still should try to persuade one single approach. If we got a different approach, as Anne said, that the empirical research showed that there are no preference which approach we should have. So for the board, when we decide which kind of approach we should have, I think we should have very strong conceptual basis to support which approach we should have, especially if we develop different approach for different scenarios. I think we should have very strong conceptual basis. So when I'm struggling to answer this question at this stage. So first thing, I look at the conceptual framework. The conceptual framework said that what kind of factors we should consider when we select a different measurement basis. I think there are several factors we should consider. Well, first, the characteristics of the assets and the liabilities, whether those assets and liabilities are sensitive to market factors. Secondly, how those assets and liabilities contribute to the future cash flows. I really appreciate the paper that the credit analysis are looking at the cash flows. I think equity investors also are looking at the cash flows, but we need to look at how those assets and liability contribute to the future cash flows. And the conceptual framework said that if those economic resources produce cash flows individually, maybe, and also some economic resources are used in combination to produce the economic, to produce the future cash flows. They may need to apply different kind of, measurement basis. So you look at the business combination, all those asset liabilities should be combined together to produce the future cash flows. So I think it's better to look at the conceptual basis and which way can more faithfully reflect what kind of form, what kind of information can help the users to judge which way produce future cash flows, help them to forecast the future cash flows. I think if it's possible, I still say that if it's possible conceptually, practically, we try to persuade one single approach. And then look at if there are some exceptional cases happened, we need to look at, then maybe we develop some kind of exceptional cases or exceptional approaches, specifically apply for those specific circumstances.
I just want to make a quick observation on the single approach, and maybe I'm repeating myself a little bit, but I just want to highlight that unless the board decides to require the acquisition method for all business combinations under common control, we will not have a single approach, because there will be one approach for business combinations and another approach for business combinations under common control. And so there will be the tension between what's considered under common control. So I think it's quite important to keep that that point in mind.
Changwu.
Thank you. I agree with anything, but you know, as Martin pointed out, there is some kind of concept what the acquisition method with some modification in this project. So because we have discussed this about that earlier. And also in the paper A, paragraph 7, you are saying that acquisition method with the modification, such a modification will not contain any recognition of goodwill rather than, you know, the distribution from equity or some contribution to equity. So this with the acquisition method you are suggesting, we are assuming there is no possibility to recognize any goodwill or bargaining gains under this model. Is it correct?
I'm not sure I fully understand the question. So
the acquisition method?
Yeah, the acquisition method we are talking about in the paper is a kind of modified acquisition method of IFRS 3, right?
So what we discuss in agenda paper 23A is that, of course, the board would need to think about where the acquisition method needs to be modified and how it needs to be modified, because the transaction price in the BCUCC may not be at fair value. And by the way, we're not presuming that it's not, but we're just saying it can be a possibility. And so in that case, what is happening economically, there is an equity transaction, there is a distribution from equity, a contribution to equity, and in addition, there is a business combination. So in those cases, arguably, the business combination itself needs to be accounted for under IFRS 3, fully sort of applying IFRS 3, but then the element which represents a contribution to equity or a distribution from equity would need to be accounted as such. That's all we're saying.
Basically, what I'm assuming when you talk about these two methods here, the acquisition method in IFRS 3, whenever you talked about that method, you said some modifications. So I interpret that modification as a kind of eliminating some kind of recognition of a goodwill. Basically, most of the difference between these consideration and the fair value of the business, then we are considering some kind of equity transaction.
It's not going as far as that, Chungwu. All it's really saying is that in a business combination under a common control, if the transaction's not at fair value, then there's an additional element to consider in the transaction, and that's an element that's not present in other business combinations. And so the board would need to think about what to do that with that. And that might mean accounting in some way for that extra feature, or it might mean not accounting for it, but you'd at least have to think about it. And we're not saying in this paper what you would do with that. We did discuss that a bit last year, but we haven't got to conclusions on that yet.
So that means that we have some kind of some possibility to recognize goodwill or bargaining gain. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Under this model.
I thought our working assumption would be if the transaction was at fair value, then normal acquisition accounting would apply. But it's coming back partly to what Martin's talking about, which is there's lots of questions, I think, which is what you'll get into, right?
Right. Another point on this acquisition method is a very important aspect is fair value measurement of land or some property, on some of the intangible assets, they can be valued at fair value if we apply the acquisition method. That's another big increase in the asset amount of the balance sheet of the combined entity. So that's another kind of a possibility that might distort the precise picture of the financial position or financial performance of the combined. That's one another thing. The last comment I suggest is Mary suggested some. We don't have a variety of there are a variety of methods. What they are like you developed for the acquisition method with modifications here, you need to make some kind of not detailed, precise definition of the predecessor method. But however, some kind of a high level, high quality form of the presidential method. We can communicate with that method on a based on common sense. So we can, you know, compare these two methods more fairly with some kind of concepts we have on these two approaches. So I'd like to suggest you develop not very detailed approach, but some kind of a description of what the predecessor method you would like to have and to discuss in the future.
Can I just repeat what Yulia said, which is we can't discuss everything at once. Mm-hmm. And we've brought these questions about which method first, because that partly involves looking at the composition of the user groups and what their needs are. And to some extent, the answers to those questions might influence how you might want to design modifications to the acquisition method or modifications to the pre-assessor method.
Nick?
The question's quite nuanced, isn't it, really?
Well, we've been very careful with how we've phrased it.
So, not sure I'm signing up for anything, actually, one way or another. I think I do support the approach that you need not support a single approach. And I think I've had comfort that I'm not necessarily signing up for a modified acquisition approach. But for the record, that would terrify me. Mm-hmm. Anything that requires us assessing the fair value of an acquisition is not where we should be going. But I think the question as it stands, I'm happy to support.
Okay. Can we vote? Yes. Who supports the staff's recommendation?
13.
Thank you.